Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 25 million people in the United States who are of childbearing age now live in areas which have severely restricted or completely banned access to abortions, and that's according to the Associated Press. In the year since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, the historic Dobbs decision essentially handed access to abortions and reproductive rights to states, 25 of which have moved quickly to restrict access to abortions, while others already had laws waiting to kick in anticipation of the Supreme Court ruling. California, on the other hand, has codified access to abortions into the state constitution, along with passing other executive and legislative laws. Our state has also laid down the welcome mat for pregnant people across the country to come and seek reproductive care, no matter where they are from. So at the moment, the landscape over access to abortions is a patchwork of different laws and regulations. Joining us now to unpack where this all stands is Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Law at UC Davis, Lisa Ikemoto, an expert in reproductive rights. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Professor Ikemoto, you joined us about a year ago, and this immediately followed the Supreme Court's ruling. Now, according to the Associated Press, there's more than 25 million women and pregnant people between the ages of 15 to 44 who live in states where there are more restrictions on abortion access than there were before Dobbs. Was all of this expected, or have you been surprised by any of the laws that have been passed in the past year by states?
I've had, there have definitely been a few surprises. I mean, the overall trend of passing more bans, passing bans with very, very narrow exceptions, passing additional types of restrictions, such as additional gestational limits, those were not a surprise. I've been surprised at the creativity of the states that have stepped up to protect abortion rights. That's part of it. And then I think that one of the other surprises has been, the use of what I'm thinking of as zombie laws. For example, several states in enacting their bans rather than create new bans, or sometimes in addition to enacting new bans on abortion, have, sort of called into play laws that were declared unconstitutional by Roe versus Wade and subsequent decisions. So, for example, Wisconsin has an abortion ban now in place because they revived an 1849 ban on abortion that existed before, long ago, you know, over a century ago. So those types of efforts.
When it comes to California, I mean, we passed a law codifying it into our constitution. It was actually voters approved it last in November. But can what California is doing from an executive, legislative, or even in terms of like a proposition, like codifying it into the Constitution, can this ever be threatened or superseded by federal law?
It's possible if there's a federal, if Congress passes a federal ban on abortion, for example, those could override our state laws that have been put into place to protect abortion access. I don't know that Congress will be able to get to that point, but that's certainly one risk for the state.
What are the biggest changes in California in the past year?
You mentioned that voters passed a ballot initiative as a Proposition 1 as of November. So before that, California had constitutional protection for access to abortion, but they made a strong statement by putting in language that expressly includes reproductive rights, including abortion and contraception access. So those words are now clear. It's not just right of privacy. So they forestalled any possibility that the right of privacy could be reinterpreted by the state Supreme Court. It's clear that abortion and contraception are now constitutionally protected. And then during the past year, the legislature's passed a number of additional statutory protections, and there's a new slate of bills in place as well. So among the protections that were put into place were privacy protections that would that would prohibit California law enforcement, for example, from sharing private information with out-of-state law enforcement who might be investigating or prosecuting cases against their residents who've traveled to California for abortions, for example. So those kinds of privacy protections have been important. One of the other types of provisions is not just sort of providing sort of an abstract legal right, but actually providing a substantial amount of financial resources to enable access to abortion for people traveling to California. And that protects not only the people who are traveling to the state, but also people who currently live in California. So that abortion remains fully available to the people living here, or at least that's the hope.
And those are a lot of enhancements. Are there other states following in suit with California?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a whole block of states, maybe 20 states, who stepped up to expand protections for abortion access, and they are learning from each other, and California has been one of the leaders in that. And I think that will continue. As I said, there's sort of a slate of new bills coming up, and some of those will be implemented both in California and by other states as well.
So what I'm hearing is there's an opportunity for collaboration among states, especially if you're bordering each other. I would imagine there's California, Oregon, and Washington, which are more liberal, especially when it comes to reproductive rights.
Yeah, I think in the Northeast in particular, in the United States, portions of the Midwest and certainly the West Coast have created sort of zones of access for sort of comprehensive reproductive health care. Part of what's being done is expanding access to gender-affirming care as well, because one of the sort of trends that kicked up in the past year has been sort of using state power to restrict access to health care has expanded very rapidly to restrict access to gender-affirming care, in particular for youth. 20 bans on access to gender-affirming care or on providing gender-affirming care to youth have been passed very recently. 17 of those were passed in this year, 2023. And so California and other states are stepping up to provide sort of, again, sort of protection for access to and resources for access to gender-affirming care as well as abortion care.
You bring up a good point in that the Dobbs decision, although specifically it was taking on, you know, the right to abortion, it had other effects from a legal, political, and even social impacts.
Yeah, I think that the Dobbs case, it sort of, you know, sort of opened the door sort of from a state legislature perspective to, again, sort of, I guess, being creative, but also maybe expanding the sort of there are ideological agendas, whether you see that as sort of pro-choice or anti-choice.
In the year leading up to the Dobbs decision, KFF, which is an independent source for health policy research, they found that, you know, healthcare for women, and I don't think that this is surprising, it's had a seismic shift in the last year, you know, 50%, and this is across the country, says that, you know, that there's patients who've been unable to obtain an abortion. Nearly half say they face constraints on their care, and nearly as many OBGYNs practicing in states with gestational limits on abortion also say they face such challenges in their practices. What impact does that have on states like California, which are willing to accept people outside of California to give them access to reproductive care and abortions?
Well, there are certainly a number of states that protect access to care, comprehensive care, that have experienced a greater number of patients traveling into those states to receive those forms of care that are restricted in their home states. Florida, for example, is one of those states. Illinois, certainly states like California, but the states that are sort of closest to the zone, the zone, right? What we have now have this zone of states that are banning access to both abortion and gender-affirming care, and just quality care for people who are pregnant. Those people are now traveling to states that are closest to them. And so you see that sort of influx. And again, you have the potential impact on the people who live in those states. Maybe it makes them a little bit harder to get an appointment And that's why states like California have dedicated not only just sort of legislation, but legislation that authorizes additional funding, even for things like transportation to clinics.
I mean, the doctor-patient relationship, it must have changed and evolved in the year since Dobbs, a relationship that typically is quite private.
Yeah, I think we've seen a number of effects coming into place. One is that doctors in states with these bans or substantial restrictions or very vague language describing the exceptions are sort of, they experience this dilemma between their professional duty and desire to provide evidence-based standard of care and the concern that they might be prosecuted or lose their medical license. So they're caught between sort of this rock and the hard place, so to speak, in those. And then the other kinds of effects that you've seen is that it's affected, there's already been a shortage. We've got a shortage in healthcare across the nation, all types of healthcare. We saw that most acutely towards the end of the official COVID pandemic period. And now what we see is that there's a national shortage in obstetrics and gynecology care. And it's affecting the medical residents who are going into that field of care, where they choose to learn. And some of them are choosing to avoid the states with bans on care. They won't get full training. They won't be able to practice medicine as they hope to be trained. Maybe, you know, one thing that some states, including California, are doing is trying to make agreements with medical schools in those states to enable those kinds of students to travel out of state so that they can receive adequate training, even though they're placed for their residencies in states with bans.
When you talk about this decision, the Dobbs decision, essentially kind of kicking the door open for people being creative with not only legislation, but also other lawsuits. I mean, there are outstanding challenges to even the use of some medication that is used in abortion, and that can have an impact on California. Where does all of that stand now?
Yeah, I mean, there was this case that was filed in Texas, the very strategic filing in a district in Texas where the judge is known to be very hostile to abortion and generally upholds abortion restrictions. So the argument was against the case was filed against the FDA, challenging the FDA's authority to approve mifepristone in particular. Mifepristone is one of the two drugs used in medication abortion, and medication abortion is used by maybe a slight majority of people who obtain abortions. So it's a very important medication. It's used for other purposes as well. So they challenged the FDA's authority. And one additional argument in that case was that the mailing of mifepristone, so delivering mifepristone and misoprostol through the mails, violated this 19th century law called the Comstock Act. So it's another one of those sort of zombie legal efforts.
Like from 1870,
that I
right?
mentioned earlier. Yes, exactly. The 1870s. It was an anti-vice law that was pushed by a man named Anthony Comstock, who was so worried that our country would be undermined by what he regarded to be sexual vice at that time, that he got a law, got Congress to pass a law that prohibited the mailing of anything to do with lewdness. And the statute mentions contraception and abortion. And the Texas judge discussed that law without saying no, it's been overruled or in a sense rendered ineffective by previous judicial decisions. And so there's still the possibility that that law could be revived. That judge issued a nationwide injunction on medication abortion or mailing of medication abortion. But that decision itself has been sort of administratively withdrawn by the Supreme Court, but we're still waiting to see what will happen in that case. It's not over yet.
When we think about the other uses for these medications that are typically on front of mind or connected to abortion, I mean, those medications also can be, and even some procedures are used during a pregnancy loss or a later term miscarriage, you know, situations when the life or the health of the pregnant person is at risk, or by not intervening with a medication or a procedure, it can create complications for future pregnancies if that person wants to get pregnant again. I don't think people really thought of that a year ago when this decision came down from the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's true. I think that many people who supported abortion bans didn't realize, probably many of us who oppose abortion bans, right, also didn't sort of fully imagine the wide scope of healthcare, particularly care, maternal care, that would be impacted by these bans, including the bans on medication abortion or efforts to restrict access to medication abortion. So doctors are stuck between the rock and the hard place with respect to use of that drug. It makes them look like they're performing an abortion, even though they're trying to help someone recover from something like a ectopic pregnancy or a miscarriage or some other condition. And then if a ban goes into place, people with other diagnoses may not be able to access that those drugs as well.
Finally, I mean, there still is some confusion over the Dobbs decision. I mean, just because, you know, it's been big national news, it doesn't mean every single person understands like the impact of it in the state that they live, especially if they live in a state where there are new restrictions to reproductive care. Like, I believe 1 in 8 people who live in states with abortion bans, and this is according to that KFF survey, they incorrectly believe that medication abortion is still legal, or more than half of residents are just unsure of what the legality of abortion is in their state. What do you think needs to be done, given that you're in the realm of academia, to bring more clarity so people just have more awareness of where things stand now?
It's hard to say. One is there is still going to be a lot of uncertainty, in part because some of the laws that have been passed have a lot of vague language in them. And some of the laws that were passed, it's not clear that they're fully enforceable. So several bans that have been placed are currently being held up in courts because of challenges that may be successful. So that's part of it. We'll never achieve perfect clarity in the law. And then the other part of it, it would be just the burden shouldn't fall exclusively on providers to help people understand sort of what care is available to them in their home states and what care is not available. Certainly public education efforts with accurate information is very, very important. Some states like California are stepping up to try to, there's a bill, for example, in the California legislature to improve the public's understanding of what care is available and how to get it.
Professor Ikemoto, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Lisa Ikemoto is a Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Law at UC Davis and an expert in reproductive rights. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thank you.